We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
What we believe about the Bible is based on what we believe about its source.
The God Who Speaks, the award-winning documentary from the American Family Association, is now available in a special limited edition DVD set. This release includes a Sunday school curriculum and 2 hours of additional footage. Go to thegodwhospeaks.org to get your copy today. thegodwhospeaks.org. Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, it is Thursday, November 14th, on yet another busy news day. And the top story that, of course, is a really big deal is that Donald Trump made a triumphant return to Washington yesterday, meeting with President Joe Biden. And the two seemed really friendly. It was actually almost hysterical, considering all of the bad blood in the past. But as I posted on social media, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so it seems like the Bidens are not too happy with Kamala Harris, and maybe a little bit more friendly with the Trumps now. But President Trump also met with the Republican conference yesterday to talk about his agenda and priorities amid the U.S. House of Representatives, once again handing the gavel to Speaker Mike Johnson. And there were a lot of things that that really changed in terms of some of the rules moving forward. So joining us now to discuss all this and more is our good friend Representative Tom Tiffany from the great state of Wisconsin. So good morning, Representative Tiffany. And, you know, this seems like a great day for Washington, at least certainly one of the better ones since the last 4 years.
Yeah, it's a really good day for the United States of America. And I love what you posted, the enemy of my enemy. And it is clear that the Bidens look back in retrospect and are just like, how could they possibly do this to us? And, you know, someone that was so loyal for 50 years. And I do think it shows the deep schism within the Democrat Party at this point. And they got a lot of problems to deal with. Now, on the front for Republicans, it's good that President Trump came in, as you said, a triumphant return to Washington, D.C. Very upbeat presentation he gave to us in the House of Representatives, and I thought it was primarily a thank you for working together to be able to gain the presidency and then also get majorities in both houses. And so that stuff is all good, but and we should celebrate that, Jenna, but I will say in the weeks to come, we're going to find out how difficult the work is to govern and to legislate. And our members really need to get ready for this, because there's tough, tough decisions to be made. And, you know, not everybody's going to be on the same page singing Kumbaya in our conference. And we got to find ways to be able to navigate that narrow majority we have to be able to accomplish the goals of the president.
Yeah, and that's a really great point. And Speaker Johnson is dealing at least with a little bit stronger majority this time around. And President Trump referred to that in the conference speech or the presentation yesterday, at least part of what I listened to, when he said, you know, hey, if we can work with just one seat, then, you know, three or four, then that's no big deal. We can work with anything. So what does Speaker Johnson have to do to get this conference all together kind of on the same page to actually push through legislation that's meaningful, especially in light of this new DOGE initiative that is going to just submit proposals that obviously Congress would have to in a large part, I mean, unless it just dealt with some of the executive action. But a lot of these proposals would be significant and something that Congress would actually have to implement.
You know, even with a slim majority, Speaker Johnson needs to be bold to advance the conservative agenda. Jenna, we know what the Democrats did in the 4 years of Joe Biden, and when they had all three parts of government, they were bold, right? They went out and they just pushed everything through. And I got to tell you, I think Speaker Johnson needs to take some lessons from Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi was like, we're going to do these things to advance our agenda. Same thing needs to happen here. One of the things that I was heartened that Speaker Johnson said yesterday, I will put my speakership on the line to get us back to fiscal responsibility, because we all know the $35 trillion in debt, or however much it is at this point, that it is a serious drag on America. And having a great America, a prosperous America, being able to give young people an opportunity in America. I mean, what was one of the things loud and clear from young people I thought was, we can't afford rent, much less being able to achieve the American dream of being able to buy a home. Part of that is driven by this excessive spending in Washington, D.C. Speaker Johnson has his work cut out for him, because even in our conference, those appropriators, they don't like to go backwards. They like to spend more money. And Speaker Johnson's going to need to put his speakership on the line, saying to them, we've got to turn back some of this excessive spending that's gone on in order to get control of our finances here for the United States of America. So it's a great challenge, and with great challenges come great opportunities. And we should all be hoping and praying for Speaker Johnson that he's up to the task.
Yeah, it sounds like he needs to get some of his spidey sense going on. So, you know, with great, great power comes great responsibility. Maybe I'll post that one later. But also, you know, with Speaker Johnson needing to helm this conference, some of the reports that came out of yesterday's, you know, House meetings are that some of the rules, at least for the incoming Congress, have changed, like the motion to vacate that threshold where it was just, you know, one vote, and that was how Kevin McCarthy was ousted, was now raised to 9 votes. So what happened in terms of the negotiations there?
So people are very focused on the motion to vacate, and appropriately so. But there's a number of other rules that were put in place 2 years ago when Kevin McCarthy achieved the speakership, and that was to have 72 hours to be able to review bills. Let's have single subject bills. There were very important transparency requirements put into the rules of the House so that the American people knew what we were doing in the House of Representatives, rather than like what Nancy Pelosi was doing in the previous session of Congress, when she was just, there were bills coming directly from her office, bypassing the committees of jurisdiction and going straight to the floor, and we'd vote on them in 2 or 3 hours. People had no idea what was in a 1,000-page bill when it only had 3 hours to be able to be reviewed. There were very important transparency things that were put in place 2 years ago. We were largely able to keep those with the negotiations that went on yesterday. The one big thing that did change is the motion to vacate. That's not entirely done, I don't think. It was set at 9 rather than 1. I actually believe that the motion to vacate is important to leave in there, because it's been around for 200 years. And after the one motion to vacate, which was successful with Kevin McCarthy, another one was done in regard to Speaker Johnson by two of our members. It failed. And so the motion to vacate, while very rarely used, it is part of our tradition in the House over 200 years, and it's important, I believe, that it stay there. The question is just the number, and I'm sure there'll be more discussion in regards to that. You know, I want to say one other thing that you brought up in regards to DOGE, the Ramaswamy and Musk effort where for government efficiency. I think this could be the way in which we could maybe get control of this crazy spending, because they're going to highlight all the nutty ways in which we spend money here in the United States of America, including overseas. And this is going to give us the opportunity, perhaps, to give Congress some cover, because congressional members just don't want to reduce spending. It's unfortunate. Generally, they just aren't there. I think that this has the potential, the DOGE, to be able to identify those things, and where we then say as Congress, you know what? We maybe better do this stuff because it really is crazy. So I'm hopeful.
That's good. And I think a lot of Americans are right there with you. And to see how much of the excess spending and where it's actually going, that's going to be posted, as Elon Musk is saying, you know, all across social media and within this new department, I think is going to be really revolutionary in terms of not allowing a lot of this to just fall under the radar. And if mainstream media isn't willing to cover it, or it seems, you know, a little too wonky, then people really don't get into the details. So, and the details, of course, are important. And, you know, one thing that you mentioned, Representative Tom Tiffany, my special guest this morning, is how Speaker Johnson needs to be a little bit more like Nancy Pelosi. And I couldn't agree more, in the sense that Democrats are often very strategic. They're willing to use the rules to their benefit, and sometimes even, you know, go around the rules or circumvent them or reinvent the rules, which, you know, as a conservative, we wouldn't necessarily replicate. But in terms of just using the process to their advantage. And one of the things that I saw with respect to Trump getting his appointees and his cabinet in place, there was a lot of pushback from, you know, some of these kind of staunch conservatives that are saying, you know, and this was from Ed Whelan, who said, I hope it's wrong, but I'm hearing through the grapevine about this bonkers plan. Trump would adjourn both houses of Congress under Article 2, Section 3, and then recess appointment his cabinet. And he goes on to criticize that. And I'm sitting there thinking, you just cited to the rule. Why wouldn't Trump use the process to his advantage if that's available to him? Like, why are we as conservatives calling that a bonkers plan?
As long as you are functioning within the rules, and you make a really good point in regards to, I'm not advocating for Mike Johnson to take some of the measures that Nancy Pelosi did, because she bent the rules and broke the rules at times and had to be challenged in court to be able to reverse course. I'm not advocating for that, but you do need to use that bully pulpit that you have. And yes, as long as you're functioning within the rules that are out there, why shouldn't you do that?
Well, exactly. And this is where I think that a lot of the voters have looked at the Republican Party for so long, saying, why are you so hesitant? Just because maybe it's not, you know, MSNBC is going to write, you know, say bad things about you. New York Times is going to write bad articles about you. Well, who cares? You know, and this is one of the ways that Governor DeSantis in Florida has been very strategic, to just look at the tools available and say, you know, like his firing of the attorneys that were Soros funded, and just saying, you know, that's within my power, so I'm going to do it. And so making those types of decisions, that to me is where the Republican conference needs to get more bold in terms of saying, okay, let's actually see what processes are available, what we can do, staying within the margins of the law and the Constitution, but actually using the powers to our benefit to be able to push through our agenda. I mean, that just seems common sense, but it seems like they have been scared to do that just because of media pushback and the Democrats challenging that, basically saying, well, you know, this isn't how it's always been done. Well, who cares?
Democrats and some Republicans, as you've cited there, Jenna.
True.
I got to tell you, President Trump's most powerful advocates and his most powerful allies are your listeners. As we saw, they were fully engaged with this Senate Majority Leader contest that went on yesterday, and people were sending a clear message. It gave Rick Scott and the conservatives, which is, there's a small block of them in the U.S. Senate, including my Senator Ron Johnson, and it gave them the ability to negotiate some good things, even though Rick Scott did not become majority leader. The same thing is going to happen here, to the point you're making, Jenna. your listeners and people across America that put President Trump in as the president, they need to stay engaged in this process. And when you see this recalcitrant, we know the Democrats are going to oppose us, but when we see these recalcitrant Republicans, and if it's legitimate that they're recalcitrant, great. We want to have good, fair debate. But if they're just like citing a process question where it turns out that the president does have the ability to do this legally, then we need to sound off and send a message to our elected representatives. You need to get on board, because the Trump agenda will make America great again.
Well said. And for everyone listening, I hope that you take that to heart and call Speaker Johnson's office this week and encourage him and say, you know, we would love for you to be bold and we are with you, and let him hear you. Let your representatives, your senators know that you are paying attention, that you want good conservative policy, that you want the swamp drain. I mean, all of these priorities, your issues, standing up for life, religious freedom, all of these things, you can make your voice heard. So that's a great way that Representative Tiffany reminds us that we do need to stay engaged, not just, you know, once every 4 years in a presidential election cycle at the ballot. So we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, Trump is definitely shaking up Washington. And as I saw in a meme yesterday, it said the Democrats are already thinking, wow, this is a long first week into a four-year term that hasn't even started yet. So I found that one really funny. And this is coming through all of his announcements of his political appointees for various cabinet positions. And one of the most controversial to date, of course, is the selection and nomination of a former, now Congressman, Matt Gaetz to Attorney General. And this kind of came in a wild succession last night. The announcement was put out, and then Gaetz resigned from Congress. And then, of course, the questions about recess appointments and so forth, and this coming in the wake of Senator John Thune being selected to replace Mitch McConnell for Senate Majority Leader. So a lot is going on, and a Politico playbook, which, you know, of course, is definitely leftist biased, had a really long piece and sort of a summary of, in their reporting at least, what happened. And it was titled Barbarians at the Gates, tongue in cheek. But it said, you know, how did we get here? The story is still coming out. But this piece was particularly interesting. It said the Gates for AG plan came together yesterday, just hours before it was announced. One of their reporters tells Playbook it was hatched aboard Trump's plane en route to Washington, on which Gates was a passenger. A Trump official revealed more details to Playbook late last night. Boris Epstein, who is one of the lawyers, played a central role in the development lobbying Trump to choose Gates, while the incoming White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles was in a different adjacent room on the plane, apparently unaware. And one of the pieces that is floating out there is this ethics report on Gates and the investigation that was set to come out as early as tomorrow and has basically been nullified by Gates now resigning his congressional seat. So a lot of things going on. And of course, the left trying to paint this as sort of a cover, and also suggesting that some of the other potential picks for attorney general had not really impressed Trump, because they were talking about, you know, their judicial philosophy and, you know, some of their fidelity to the Constitution. And Gates came in there and, you know, said, well, I just want to come in and, you know, make heads roll, but a little more colorful language, which impressed Trump. And I could see how that one would be accurate. But this is a very interesting pick, and the response to this has been wide and varied. So could A. Gates actually get confirmed? Well, let's welcome in Ken Cuccinelli, who is currently the senior fellow at the Center for Renewing America, but no stranger to the Trump administration. He was a senior official performing the duties of Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security from 2019 to 2021. So, Ken, good morning. And overall, you know, what do you make of Trump's cabinet picks so far? Because I'm seeing kind of the common thread of just, let's blow up the Washington establishment, and, you know, the leftist tears are flowing.
Well, their tears were going to flow no matter what. So they might as well open the faucets for that. But, you know, and you're also seeing the loyalty requirement here. That wasn't true with John Kelly or Rex Tillerson on the first go around. So, you know, he's solving that problem. And, you know, Matt was last night's news. I say last night's because, you know, as you noted, it's been rolling pretty quickly. And, you know, it'll be interesting. I think Thune was probably concerned in his run for majority leader. He only got it by 5 votes. And the primary concern there was that he wasn't going to be sufficiently supportive of President Trump. And a nomination like Matt Gaetz is going to test that. And I think at this point in time, he probably wants to pass that test. So at least I think from the majority leader, you're going to get help and support. You know, there's still enough old bulls in the Senate that he could have a problem. But combined with the close look, and Center for Renewing America is taking a very close look at the very notion of these recess appointments. When you combine it with the Vacancies Act, you can cover over 2 years of time in leadership by the president's chosen leaders without going through the Senate process. And I don't think the Senate wants that to happen. So that's leverage in a negotiation for them to give great sway to the president's choices. And I think you're going to see that here.
And that's a really fascinating lever that Trump had not historically used. And we saw, of course, in his first administration that a lot of his appointments were held up through lengthy, you know, confirmation processes or, you know, other just, you know, media bulking and some of those things. So from your experience in the first administration to what you're seeing now, even, you know, before the administration has started, I mean, you know, this has been a little over a week since the election and already it's like we've lived through 100 news cycles of Trump's announcements. Do you think that this shows that maybe Trump and those around him have learned from what didn't work in 2016?
Well, I mean, they certainly learned some of it. Trump did. I mean, you know very well he doesn't admit errors readily. And yet in the campaign, he said, yeah, my big mistake was. And he talked about exactly this. You know, the question now becomes, you know, there are some interesting elements to some of these picks. Like Senator Rubio, anybody in the world would say he's qualified to be Secretary of State, but he is a neocon. And, you know, that is something that the president campaigned against. So is Senator Rubio prepared to set aside his worldview to advocate the president's wholeheartedly 100%? I hope he wouldn't have said yes if the answer to that question wasn't yes. And then in the Department of Homeland Security, obviously what I'm familiar with, you compare his two biggest promises, the economy and deporting 10 million people. The economy, the president needs to apply his political capital and pull the levers of power he has, like regulation, which he controls. He can do all that relatively straightforwardly. Doesn't mean people won't sue him over this or that, but he has control over that. And then the economy does the work. As you and I know, presidents get credit for it. But in terms of improving the economy, it's not like he's going to go do all those jobs. They're going to get filled. He's going to clear the way for companies to hire and invest. And I have great confidence that's going to happen. But on the second promise, the deportation, the government has to do it themselves. They have to do – this is a massive logistical undertaking, folks, massive. Just to remove 1 million people a year takes 60 full airline flights a day flying home. That's just 1 million. And you're talking about getting up to 3 or 4 million in a year. That's – 240 flights in one day. And it isn't just about having the airplanes and running them. You have to get the people to those airplanes. They have to be in a legal posture for deportation. You've got to, of course, manage all the lawsuits that are incoming about all of it. And you have to handle the communications and political pressure. Let's face it, There are plenty of Republicans that when this agenda gets going, when he starts deporting people, including families, that there are plenty of Republicans who are going to balk in Congress, and that may mean that they start adjusting their cooperation in the appropriations process. So we'll see. I mean, that is a huge challenge that can't just be dished off on the American people. And I don't mean dished off like he's washing his hands of it. The president is going to get the economy going. I'm very confident of that. But again, he doesn't have to do the work for that of the economy. The economy will do it. For the deportations, it's going to be his team doing it, his people. And, you know, we'll see who they bring in, who's going to be the head of ICE, which is going to be the point position, who's going to be the head of CBP, which actually is only going to be interesting the first few months because they're going to close that border using the military, and the only place people are going to come in is legal ports of entry, which is what should have happened a long, long time ago, but now it's going to happen under Donald Trump. And so then the focus will simply turn to the deportation.
And I'm speaking with King Cuccinelli, who's a senior fellow at the Center for Renewing America and was a senior official in the first Trump administration in DHS. And so, Ken, what do you make then of the selection of South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem for DHS and also Tom Homan? Because a lot of the pushback, I mean, speaking of qualifications, even though, you know, there are some that are pushing back against some of the other picks like Pete Hegseth and so forth, who actually has a pretty lengthy resume for being able to be the defense secretary. which is interesting. But MSNBC didn't want to talk about that. But it seems like Kristi Noem was an interesting choice. One of the things that I've heard about that particular selection is that, you know, Tom Homan would do a lot more of the work, but she would be a little bit more of the figurehead, which if you are deporting families and children, and especially women, then that's kind of a little bit more difficult to push back against a woman in that role.
Oh, give me a break. Come on. are we now going to start doing this kind of sexist crap on our side of the aisle like the left does? You don't run operations out of the White House. I was really excited to see Tom Homan there in the White House because now they'll have an operator's perspective. You know, he headed ICE. You actually have to go find the people. You have to arrest them safe. You have to detain them safely. You have to transport them. You've got to do all this at scale and with numbers and efficiently enough to get through large numbers of people. Tom Homan knows that because he's lived with it. Not at the scale we're talking about, by the way. No one has. But to have that perspective in the White House is great. But you do not do the work in the White House. That is not where the work happens. So, you know, if anybody thinks she's only capable of being a figurehead, then this is going to fail. She's going to have to succeed for this part of the president's agenda to succeed. But it isn't just Kristi Noem. It's the Secretary of Treasury. It's the Secretary of State. It's the Secretary of Defense. It's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who has all of the children, you know, in their custody, and that has so often been a bottleneck in the past. And those people find immigration icky. They just don't want to touch it. That was true in the first Trump administration. They didn't want to get anywhere near it. And so they didn't do anything. They didn't put any effort into it. And so they were a huge bottleneck. So the Department of the Interior owns an enormous portion of the borderland. All those secretaries are going to be involved. And if they're not, this isn't going to succeed.
And with that, then, do you see these choices compared to your experience in the first term? And you've spoken even to me on this program about, you know, wanting to implement Trump's agenda, and people around you didn't have, you know, that same vision. And there were problems, you know, even within the personnel. And personnel was a big deal. And that has been a big question mark even since the primaries for Trump. With his appointment so far, I mean, it seems like the loyalty factor is the biggest metric. And then a lot lot of these people are just well known, at least in the media. Do you see all of these people coming together with their varied or not qualifications to be able to implement this kind of agenda so far?
Well, I certainly think that it's entirely possible. I think that, I have no qualms about Gates's qualifications, his alignment with the president. And look, bringing DOJ into line at the FBI in particular is going to be critically important. One appointment we haven't seen is his proposed director of the FBI. And that's going to be obviously very critical. But he set very high goals for himself. And I see him bringing in folks and Lee Zeldin, for example, who will help shift EPA back to just keeping air and water clean and getting out of the way of advancing the economy. And I see other people like Matt Gaetz, who are totally aligned with the president in a very tough area. DOJ has a lot of work to do. The real question, I think, and I think it's fair to ask this of many of these folks, is the scale of the management requirement, which is never talked about. It's never talked about. That is, they're called upon to undertake here is enormous. And management skills just don't happen. There's no management in a congressional office. You have like 12 people. The Department of Justice has about 120,000 people. The Department of Homeland Security has half the population of Kristi Noem's home state. And, it doesn't have mission alignment. The Department of Defense kills people and breaks things five different ways. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and now Space Force. Very close mission alignment. The Department of Homeland Security was set up after 9/11 as a political action, so bipartisan elected officials could go back home and look busy to their constituents. You don't have the kind of mission alignment among those eight agencies and 22 components that you do, say, in the Department of Defense. Like, we're focusing a lot on immigration, and we should, because it was one of the president's top promises. But you also have to keep the president alive. And that's the Secret Service's job. And I don't know if you've noticed lately, they haven't been doing a very good job of that. The Secretary of Homeland Security is responsible for cleaning that up as well. And that's going to take a lot of her attention. A figurehead doesn't get the Secret Service fixed. So I totally reject the notion of people who are seeing Tom Homan doing the work and her as a figurehead have it exactly backwards. Tom Homan sets the agenda as the borders are. He will be heavily responsible for coordinating with other departments. The interdepartmental coordination should run from the White House. The Secretary of State doesn't work for the Secretary of Homeland Security, but he does work for the White House. And so Tom Homan is positioned to handle that, and it is critically important to have that all whole of government approach. That's where Tom Homan's focus should be. And if you don't have a secretary and a leadership team that can carry this logistical and management challenge to a scale that's never been done domestically, then this is just isn't going to succeed. But who knows? Maybe the measure of success that I have in my head is too high. Maybe they just want to get to 2 million people deported. If that's the case, they'll be able to pull that off just with political will.
I'm speaking with Ken Cuccinelli, and he is a senior fellow at the Center for Renewing America, and of course was in the first Trump administration. And, I think there is so much focus on people who have not had the experience and the direct involvement in these areas of government as you to focus more on the media, because Trump has been very famously so focused on what the media will say about his appointments and so forth. And hopefully that isn't his strategy as much as it appeared to be in the first administration. And you and I both know, having worked with him, that he is very cognizant of what the media is saying about him instead of just strategic and wanting to implement his agenda and getting the things in place, and, you know, kind of who cares what the criticism is at the end of the day. If he gets things done, that will speak for itself. And so I hope that there is a little bit of shift in that mentality. But let's talk then about DOGE, which I think is one of the more interesting ideas that has come out so far. And there has been a lot of, you know, back and forth on what Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy could actually accomplish if this is just all suggestions. Representative Tom Tiffany in the segment before you said, you know, just the sunshine element of saying, you know, let's tell the American people where all of this money is going is going to be effective. How do you view that particular new department?
I view it with great optimism, and I agree with the comment that sunlight alone can have an awfully significant effect, particularly if the Republicans, you know, the kind of, I expect them to not reorganize things. I expect them to eliminate things. Mm-hmm. And you can do that with majority votes in the Senate using the budget process. So, you know, they could have their own whole section of the budget every year where they just eliminate stuff. That they can do via the budget. You know, restructuring, actual restructuring, moving things in the governmental org chart, if you will, does take Congress. But there are a lot of things they can do on their own. And I'm excited about the aggressiveness, frankly, their existence. And if they reach widely and far, and they have an impact quickly, honestly, government will respond. Government workers don't want to be eliminated. I found when I ran USCIS, 20,000 employees, $5 or $6 billion budget, very, very left-leaning part of the Department of Homeland Security. But what I found was by bringing greater efficiency to the work that we were supposed to be doing, they had greater respect. They want to be seen as good professionals. They want to be seen as doing their job well. And if you help people do their job well, you get more out of them. And I think that's a very legitimate goal here. It isn't just elimination, it's improvement. And I think it's going to be a breath of fresh air to turn these guys loose on it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. And in just about the last minute we have with you, Ken Cuccinelli, and I so appreciate your time and your comments. I mean, I think this has been one of the more fascinating subjects. Just real quickly, your thoughts on Tulsi Gabbard's appointment.
I am one of those people who am fed up with the intelligence community being weaponized against the American people. And I am encouraged that the selection here is one of a kindred spirit on that front, and who goes in with some military experience. She's not unfamiliar with intelligence. You know, it's different than managing the whole enterprise, but in my view, protecting the American people from the intelligence community, unfortunately, sadly, has to be one of the top priorities in that position, and Tulsi Gabbard will do that.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited for that appointment. So, Ken Cuccinelli, really appreciate your comments, and it'll be interesting. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And one of the other stories that is really big across the country that is kind of missing its moment in the headlines because of all of the Trump news, and I think, you know, deservedly so, we're focusing on the next administration and so forth, but we really need to talk about the Daniel Penny trial. So this is the former U.S. Marine who's currently on trial in New York City for the death of a 30-year-old homeless man following this incident on a subway train in 2023. Where this homeless man came onto the subway, was at least, you know, making some remarks and threats and so forth. And so the Marine intervened and then ultimately was charged with second degree manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. So that trial is ongoing. There have been a lot of public reaction to this and a lot of fundraising going on in favor of Daniel Penny. So to break this all down and let us know what has been going on in this trial is James Parker. He's a radio host in Dallas at WBAP and has been following this trial very closely. So, James, great to talk with you. And give us kind of the landscape of what's been going on in New York.
So he's got two charges against him. One of them is involuntary manslaughter. The other one is negligent homicide. So I don't know how you can have two charges for one guy dying, but we'll stick with that. We have testimony coming from people on the train in the trial this week, and that's the new reporting. That, and there's a new video that came up in the trial that we hadn't seen before. But prosecutors are saying that he held the chokehold too long. He should have known because he's a Marine with training in such things. And Daniel Penny is saying that I restrained him until he stopped moving, and then I let go, and it's unfortunate that he died. And so that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, and, you know, the defense's argument here is that this was basically self-defense and also defense of others, and so his actions were justified, that Penny didn't intend to cause the death of this homeless man who came on, and there was a threatening situation. So we've had, at least according to some of the reports I've read, we've had some witness testimony that's saying that they felt it was justified, others that felt that they didn't. And so as you've been following this trial, where has the evidence led in terms of this particular defense to say, you know, this guy came in and needed to be stopped, and basically the defense's argument is that this was justified?
Well, a lot of concern you have with a case like this is you read the headlines and you're worried that the headline might be misleading, so you go read further into it. And the headline's not misleading. There was a guy who got on the train. He was obviously homeless. You know, when you have the saggy, dirty clothes, you know, you recognize a vagrant when you see it. He's actively threatening people, and it's like an actionable threat that he could actually pull off. He's saying, I don't have any food. I don't have any drink. I'm fed up. I'm going to jail. I don't care about going back to prison. I'm ready to die. Someone's going to die today. He's lunging at people. And so you have a guy who just restrained him until people could get off the train. And the part where I don't understand is the prosecutor's idea that he held him too long. Well, are you supposed to just let him go after a minute or two, even though he's still fighting you, even though he's still making threats, even though he's still screaming, even though he's still dangerous? I don't get the logic there, but when you watch the news on it, they seem to be on the prosecutor's side, and that just blows my mind even more. And when I say the news, we're talking about the regular suspects here. Like, if you go on ABC News, they're like, well, you know, yeah, he held him too long, and even when he went limp, and then when the cops were there, he just stood there all calm like a crazy person and answered the questions. And this is one of those where I think most of the American people see it one way, and then the media just has their own little take on it, and they're telling a different story than what you're actually seeing on the tape. The guy is saying he's going to kill people. The guy is making actionable threats against women, against a woman with a baby, against old people. And so we have guys stepping up. We have a guy being a hero. We have a guy protecting the people around him, and it's unfortunate that the chokehold ended up in this guy dying. But that's the sort of play stupid game, win stupid prizes mentality that it just blows my mind that this guy got charged in the first place.
And speaking of James Parker, who's a radio host in Dallas, Texas at WBAP, and I think that exactly what you're expressing, James, is the public sentiment here. And, you know, what I saw even when I was on both the prosecution and defense side in criminal practice in Colorado is that you have this kind of notion from most prosecutors that somehow in the very pristine, you know, sort of chamber that is the courtroom, that is not the real world where you can parse every single element here, that somebody like a U.S. Marine, when they're seeing a homeless person that is clearly presenting a threat to himself and to others, that intervenes, that somehow he's supposed to know, okay, the first 62 seconds were justified, but 63 and beyond, well, that's going to get me, you know, these ridiculous felony charges. I mean, it's not that simple. And I've seen even cases where, you know, in multiple stabbings, for example, the prosecution arguing, well, you know, stabs 1 through 3, that was justified in self-defense, but stab 4, you know, that's where we really want to have a guilty verdict. And I'm thinking, you know, this all happens so quickly in the real world. It's not the courtroom where you can break this down, you know, one moment into an hour-long discussion, that it seems like it's patently unfair to somebody like Daniel Penny. And I think that's where the public would agree with you. And I would agree with that sentiment of saying, you know, how is this guy who is simply trying to protect public safety and protect people from harm, now he's on trial, you know, for his life. And that seems to be such an over exaggeration, even though it's very unfortunate that the homeless man died. But if had he not been in that position and threatening other people and threatening himself, you know, then he wouldn't have had to be restrained to begin with. So it just seems like, you know, this type of over prosecution is what a lot of this whole weaponization of government, whole entire conversation among conservatives is at. Do you view that in terms of where, you know, your listeners in Dallas and what you've been hearing about it? I mean, I think this case really plays into that whole notion of weaponization of government.
Well, there's weaponization of government, but it's also filling that vacuum in the narrative that America is a hateful, racist place, and the demand for racism far outstrips the supply. So if you went and look at the Wikipedia page on this, in the first sentence, they point out that the homeless guy was black, and the former Marine, Daniel Penny, is a white guy. So there's the racial aspect
matters
to this.
Yeah.
And that just turned some people's brain off. You saw in Ferguson with Michael Brown, there were 15 witnesses that said he did hands up, don't shoot. Well, that never happened. So what you had was a bunch of witnesses with some pre-existing racial grievance who saw a white guy kill a black guy, and they wanted to make sure he didn't get away with it, even if they had to lie. So we've had something similar to that in this case, where one of the witnesses was telling a different story than all the other witnesses. And the suspicion there is some of this animus is racially motivated. And that's just unfortunate. And it's easy to prove the racial focus on this because, hey, ABC, when have you ever done a story about a white guy who accidentally killed another white guy? When have you done the story? If the two guys were both black, you know this wouldn't be national news. I think we all suspect, and rightfully so, that the racial makeup of these two, if it had been reversed, it wouldn't be a story. There's a racial element there. There's also sort of the gun rights crowd is interested in this because it's evident that they just don't want you to defend yourself, period. We know they get upset if you defend yourself with the gun. They got upset with George Zimmerman. They get upset in some of these other high-profile cases. But now you can't even do a chokehold. They just don't want you to defend yourself, is what it seems like. Give me the scenario where I'm getting attacked by a bad guy, and you'll defend my rights if I accidentally kill this guy who's committing a crime. I can't think of a story. I can't think of one, especially one that has this terrible racial element on it.
Really good points. And, you know, the right to self-defense, we would argue, is a natural right. And, you know, it is ridiculous that, you know, even some of these stand your ground laws, you know, the left has pushed back against, that if somebody is committing burglary and, you know, they accidentally get injured in, or even intentionally in the course of commission of a crime, then it's the homeowner that has to, you know, pay their medical bills and may even be charged with a criminal offense. I mean, that's patently absurd. So I think you're absolutely right to point out those elements. James Parker, really appreciate your commentary this morning. And so we'll be following the Daniel Penny case, be praying for justice in that case. And it'll be very interesting to see what the New York jury has to say about it when this goes to verdict. Really quickly before we go, make sure that between now and November 25th, you are participating in Operation Christmas Child. You can visit SamaritansPurse.org/OCC to learn more. Find a Dropbox location or drop-off location near you to pack a standard-size shoebox. Drop it off next week, November 18th to 25th. Shoeboxes will be collected for Operation Christmas Child, and you can find out what to pack in the shoeboxes, how to participate, and spread the good news of the gospel of Christ through your shoebox. Again, that is SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And don't miss On Demand this week. It's been posted. We do an even deeper dive into Trump's appointments so far. I'll see you tomorrow morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.